Pete Waterman, welcome to the Mouthcast. How are you, sir?
Excellent, thank you.
Excellent. Well, we're going to be taking a look back across your career, including, obviously, plenty of talk about Stock Aitken and Waterman. But before we do, let's have a listen to something. These are words I would never have imagined myself saying on this podcast, but here's a burst of Jason Donovan with Too Many Broken Hearts.
www.themouthmagazine.com.
Jason Donovan with Too Many Broken Hearts, one of many hits to be released out of the Stock Aitken and Waterman stable over the late 80s, early 90s. There was a distinct sound to many of those records and actually a distinct feel to the songs themselves. In terms of the sound, there was a little bit of high energy, a bit of disco and whatever else. But in terms of the songs, I would say there was a lot of Motown influence and a lot of soul in there.
Oh yeah, I mean that's my background. You know, I started DJing in very early 60s and I started collecting records way back in the very early 50s. My collection, you know, was mainly Motown and R&B. There was a little bit of British pop, but not a lot. And I mean, I found it sort of weird that mid 70s thing after, you know, sort of late 60s, once the Beatles had gone. And you started getting glam acts, so I found it very difficult to play those in my, you know, the place I played as a DJ. You just had to go to Motown and find Northern Soul. There was no choice.
Okay, so those, just as a side point here then, those glam records, I presume you're talking about people like T-Rex and Bowie.
That's funny, you see, I could play Bowie, I could play T-Rex, I could even play Summer Sweet, but I couldn't play the bands that came on the back of that. You know, Suzy Quatro was just about acceptable, but then when we got more glam than that, Mott the Hoople and onwards there, I couldn't play that stuff. Bowie, I could play any time. Everybody would go for Bowie. I could even play things like Smoke on the Water and Whiskey in the Jar, right? But it was when that New Romantic thing came out, it was very difficult. Thompson Twins, when they came out, it sort of changed it again. And Blancmange and people like that, you could play.
Yeah.
And I guess for me, it was that Thompson Twins and Blancmange that really inspired what I wanted to do.
Okay.
Because Trevor Horn had done Lexicon of Love with ABC.
Which is one of the greatest records ever made, not least because of the production.
Yeah, and you know, I was fanatical about Bowie's Let's Dance album. And I thought, well, this is what we do. If we put all this technology with this, it just worked. Because what had really happened, in fact, it's easy to look back now and see it, the single market had been neglected by the record companies. They hated the single market. So even when the New Romantic thing came in, they were more interested in pushing the album. The single was only a way to get you into the album. Well, the truth is, most of the singles were fantastic. Most of the albums were blinking awful. And so you bought the single, you played the single to death, but you never played the album.
You mentioned Bowie's Let's Dance, and I think there's something really interesting there that Nile Rodgers produced that, and his brief from Bowie was, do what you do. And when Niles asked Bowie, what do I do? Bowie said, well, you make hits. You know, we were talking about singles and albums. I guess, as you say, albums quite often were substandard. The singles were the great songs and the albums were substandard. But do you feel, looking at the way the industry is now and the fact that people can buy individual tracks digitally, that that's had an effect on the quality of albums?
There's no question. I mean, I was on the charts committee 10 years ago when they started to try and bring in the download onto the chart. And I was going, you do that, you've killed your album market. Yeah. So the very thing that you want, you're going to kill. Because if you can give the public the song they want for 80p, they're not going to give you £9 for an album that they don't want. So you'll find that this actually is not the market that you want. For me, it's exactly what I do. It's what I've always done. I've made things that people want to buy. You've made things that people want to own, and there's a difference.
Yeah.
So once you take the artist out of the equation and they're only as good as their next hit, then it's down to what people want to buy. And if we go right up to date with Spotify and all the streaming, the record industry really shot itself in the foot as far as sales are concerned. But now they're making huge sums of money off streaming, so they don't care about sales anymore.
I think there's a resurgence of the vinyl market as well, but I'm still in two minds. I still wonder whether that is nostalgia from people of a certain age, people my age.
I think it's nostalgia. Not that it's wrong. No, you know, there's nothing wrong with a bit of nostalgia. It's not what it used to be, but there you go. But I personally still love to listen to the crackles on records, so I'm not frightened to play on my radio show. Records got crackles on it. You know, that's part of the fun to me. I have to say, I'm still the generation that likes to own something,
yeah.
Literally pick up the record and physically see it. But I'm also sus enough that I love the technology where you can have 25,000 tunes on your phone and you can listen to whatever you want when you want it.
Yeah.
But I mean, yeah. I think it also brings in, you know, currently one of our problems is that we're spoilt for choice now. There's too much choice. And consequently, you never make a decision because the choice is bloody phenomenal. And when you go back to the very early days of Stock Aitken Waterman, you have to understand we needed the hits to pay the wages. We couldn't have carried on unless we had a hit. I mean, we had this mentality of we needed to sell because we sold 12 inches. Everybody in those days gave them away. We didn't. We had to sell them. We needed to sell 50,000 literally to keep the bills open. And at 50,000, we literally only did keep the doors open. So, you know, this was a situation where when we started working with Dead or Alive, when we went down the pub, we could afford one pint. We nicked two glasses to make it look like we could afford three pints of beer. I mean, that's not exaggeration. No. That is the truth.
That's incredible, really.
Well, and that drove us, you see. That gave us a focus. You didn't have the luxury of sitting down and spending 3 months making an album or 4 months, whatever it was. We just didn't have that luxury.
Yeah.
So if you look at Dead or Alive, who were an album band at that point, that's the way that Sony saw them, or CBS as they were then. But to me, when Pete Burns played me Spin Me Round, I stopped work on everything else because I knew that that was the one that would make us the money to do the rest, because we were, in our own mind, we've got to pay the rent.
And I guess, you know, all your work as a DJ, so therefore immersed completely in music for many years, gave you a really good ear for what was going to be a hit.
Yes. You know, as a DJ, I still to this day, even working in radio, I still mentally see the person listening to the record.
Right.
That's what Mecca taught me. Mecca taught me to watch the audience. Don't listen to it. Watch it. So whenever I play a record, I mentally envisage the way people dance or listen. And I do my playlist for my show, and it's the same as when we were in the studio. I have lots of titles, but I'd move around to the one that I felt was right at the time. So, you know what I mean? It would literally be, Mike would say, have you got a song title? And I would literally see myself on the stage at the Locarno in Coventry announcing the record.
That's interesting.
Did it work? Too Many Broken Hearts, it sounds like a hit before you've even heard the song.
Yeah. How do you feel then about, say, bands like The Smiths and Belle and Sebastian, who had these incredibly wieldy song titles, yet they were still hits? How do you feel about a song called Heaven Knows I'm Miserable Now, for instance? I guess wouldn't have made it through the Pete Waterman.
No, because I've never been miserable. I don't know what it is to be miserable. Do I want to write a song about being miserable? No, thanks. I've never considered life worth being miserable for. My glass is always half full, it's never half empty.
Attitude is everything, isn't it?
Yeah, it is for me.
Yeah.
You know, drilling off like Morrissey, fine, that's fantastic. I ain't got no problem with him, but I wouldn't, you know, when he came into the studio to see Pete Burns at the time, I just could never understand why he was so bloody miserable. He's making a fortune.
Morrissey and Pete they were quite good friends, I think.
Yeah,
so I guess he
turned up while he was doing Spin Me Round. I mean,
really?
You know,
really?
We saw Morrissey while we were doing that first album.
How did you get on with him? Because he's a notoriously difficult character and you're a notoriously amenable character. So I'd imagine it was like a clash.
No, I can be bloody difficult, let me tell you.
Okay.
I can be as bloody pig-headed as Morrissey if I want to be.
Right.
But I respect people for what they do. Now, I might not like what they do, but I respect them. You know, the one thing about him, he is true to his heart. That's him. That's what he believes in. He sticks to it. He doesn't do anything else. And whether I like it or not is irrelevant. He may not like what I do, but he knows that I stick to what I do. He knows I'm passionate about it, the same as he's passionate, and I respect that.
Roadblock.
think I'm going to ask you a question which, when I set off, might sound like I'm about to offend you, but please bear with me till the end and you'll see that.
Okay, nothing offends me, by the way.
Okay. One of the surprising things about you was that you managed the specials for a while, and just that fact alone may seem really bizarre to some people, because, with all due respect, the specials have always had a lot of credibility, but to some people, you haven't. And I find that really interesting, because I'm not sure what there is to be offended about when someone did basically what Berry Gordy did, create a hit factory, if you like. Do you feel that you were never really given your due in that way?
Oh, no. To be honest, it's not what I did it for. I just love music. I've never thought once about credibility at all.
I personally would say you've got a lot of credibility, because you did exactly what you set out to do. And what is there to not respect about that?
Right there, in a nutshell, is me. I do what I want to do. I don't do what other people want me to do. When I saw the specials, they were called the Coventry Automatics. I thought they were amazing. Amazing. I didn't sit and say, well, this is punk reggae, this is whatever it was, blue beat. I just went, this is amazing. The social context of Jerry Dammer's songs, to me, was amazing. You know, I still think, particularly right now with all the politics that's going on, everybody should look back at Jerry Dammer's lyrics from 1980, you know, 1970s, whatever it was, that late 70s, because I don't think anybody realised just how good the specials were in terms of political lyrics. You know, people might say, people want me to write political lyrics. But of course, we were living in a city that was a ghost town.
Yeah.
That's why Jerry wrote Bloody Ghost Town. You know, I know what it was like. I know what it was like for Linville and Neville, those guys being black. And my store, we didn't care what you were. So Neville used to hide out in my store all the time from the truant officers. You know, so to me, it was about music.
Yeah.
It was bluesy, it was reggae, it was soul, it was whatever. And my little store in Coventry, we didn't give a fucking monkeys. If you love music, you could come in and you could hear whatever you wanted. Virgin was downstairs, so if you wanted Roy Harper, you went downstairs. If you wanted Marvin Gaye, you come upstairs. But how much more multicultural can you get than that?
Yeah,
and that was
absolutely
1975, 76.
Quite interestingly, they're still, I mean, I saw the specials about 6 months ago, I think. It was still Ghost Town. They started with Ghost Town and it still felt resonant.
Yeah. I remember we were going to a gig. We were in a van, and this is shit. I'm giving me blinking age away here now. We were going, I don't know where the gig was, but it was certainly North London-ish. We ended up in Milton Keynes. We went wrong. We got off the highway because there was traffic or whatever it was. And we ended up in Milton Keynes, and they hadn't finished Milton Keynes.
Okay.
So all of the, so there were no names for Milton Keynes. They were areas. And Jerry wrote that song, you know, Area 54. And
yeah,
it was
like,
because we're in this place that they hadn't even given street names. They'd become areas, you know. It was just, he was that good at picking up the way it was.
Yeah, he had his finger on the pulse.
Oh, I mean, we had strikes, we had riots going on. You know, Jerry was in this band without his teeth. He did everything wrong, you know.
Yeah, but he seemed to get it so right in doing it wrong, almost.
Well, because you walked away, you've done too much. Much too young, now you're married with a kid, then you should be having fun. Da, da, da. I mean, it's a pop song, for Christ's sake.
Yeah,
it's got a fantastic lyric.
Yeah.
Everybody gets it straight away, walks away singing it, and he does it in a way that's different. You know, you've not seen that before. The one problem I had with Jerry was Terry Hall.
Right.
I didn't understand Terry Hall until I suddenly realised that Terry's got an amazing voice. It's just not, he doesn't sing like Marvin Gaye, but
in
his own way, Terry Hall has got a very distinctive voice. And that was a lesson that I learnt right there and then. It was like, oh, right, okay. Actually, it's not about being able to sing, it's about having a very distinctive voice. Pete Burns got a very distinctive voice.
So how would you apply that then to accusations is a bit of a strong word, I think, but this idea that because Stock Aitken and Waterman was a factory, the singers of the songs were interchangeable almost.
Well, that's because the people that said that were not into music. They're into being journalists, and they were more about their own credibility than listening to music. And I proved that with Roadblock.
Yes.
Too many
yes.
people look at a label and make a decision before they wrote the bloody record. Well, hey, not me, you know.
I thought that was a stroke of genius, Roadblock. That was the record that you put out, not under the Stock Aitken and Waterman name, which became a bit of a cult classic, and then it was revealed that it was actually Stock Aitken and Waterman, which I thought was a beautiful way of throwing egg onto the face of those critics, I must say.
Well, to be honest, it wasn't meant to do that. It was meant to be egg on the face of one of our own staffers, a bit of a laugh.
Okay.
Because he was a bit of his own, bum. But one guy, it's really interesting. We never fooled one guy, Chris Hill, you know the DJ Chris Hill?
Oh, yeah, right.
We never fooled him. I remember him ringing me hours after the record came in from America, and he went, Walkman, this is you. How the bloody hell did you know that? He said, because it's bloody brilliant. Only you would understand what all the elements are.
Yeah.
And I know your guys can play this stuff, because I've been there. This is somebody that understands this and can play it.
I always thought that was interesting about you, actually, because my perception, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but my perception of Stock Aitken and Waterman was that you were the driving force and quite possibly the ideas man, if you like. So you'd obviously spent a long time listening to records and working out all of the pop smarts, all of the things that make songs great, all of those little elements that make songs great. Did you find yourself doing that from very young, if you like?
Yeah, as a kid, yeah, absolutely. Right back in the very early 50s, you know, when I was buying records, that none of my mates were buying, and I had a quite unique collection. And I think, obviously, I'd been having hits since the early 70s. But when I found Matt and Mike, the interesting thing was, for the first time, I could find two musicians that had as much knowledge about music and playing as I had about records and the audiences. Because I think that's, you know, a fact that people forget. Matt Aitken is some guitarist, I promise you. He can play anything. When we worked with Rob Alford and the guys, they wanted Matt to play the guitar. They preferred Matt than their heavy metal. They thought Matt could play better heavy metal guitar than they could. So when you've got guys like Mike and Matt that literally are great musicians, they really are, and you've got your knowledge of the way music works, their knowledge because they've been playing in bands and on cruise ships to make a living, you've got three guys with enormous knowledge of music, enormous knowledge. Yeah, and I can walk in and say, I want a song like this, and they go, oh, bugger off, we know what you mean. They got any titles? Yeah, here's a title, never going to give you. Oh, bugger off, we'll see you later.
See, I think that's really interesting, because another person that I've spoken to who has that same facility as you there is Bernard Butler, used to be in the band Suede, and then went on and had that massive hit with David McAlmont,
yeah,
the song Yes. And what he was able to do was listen to Motown, to Dusty Springfield, to a lot of orchestrated pop, and he instinctively knew what each element was that made it great, and he was able to come up with a formula to write a song and produce a record using those elements. And I think that is a massive skill, actually. I don't think a lot of people could do that, which is, again, that's partly why I always admired Stock Aitken and Waterman, even if I didn't necessarily like the music.
Yeah. For me, I've always said I had the best job in the world. I was a kid in the candy store.
Yeah.
I was a kid that went down, you know, in the 50s. I went down the record store, bought all the records, went home and played them time and time again. And probably I didn't, but I could have been bouncing up and down on my bed with an airbrush because I knew them that well. You know, when Stock Aitken Waterman came in, I was there making them and I could sing them before anybody else heard them. I guess one of the problems for you is by the time I'd finished the mix, I'd moved on. So I never really enjoyed when the public sort of went, oh, we love this. It was a hit and it was number one and the radio was playing it. I'd already moved on by then because I'm on the next Jason Donovan single, the next Kylie single. So I never got to enjoy the hits when they were hits. I enjoyed them before. And later when now when you go to the Rick concerts or the Kylie concerts, it's great now because you can see for the first time what those singles really sounded like with some time behind them.
You've just mentioned Kylie, actually, and I did want to ask you about her career in the sense that, you know, she was well known for being an actress in Neighbours, which itself was a TV show that possibly wouldn't have survived without the success it had in the UK. It was an Australian show.
Yeah.
But you actually launched her pop career. I get the feeling that even if it hadn't been Stock Aitken and Waterman, she was going to be a star anyway.
I went around the record industry. I did not want to put out the Kylie Minogue record. And I went to everybody, including Simon Cowell, and they all turned it down on one ground. Soap stars do not make pop records. Even though we had five records or six records in the top 10 that week, everybody turned down Kylie Minogue. Now, you'd have thought the very fact that we were number one and had other records in the top five, you'd take a punt for... I was asking for 1,500 quid, by the way. So you'd have thought, well, 1,500 quid, I'll take a punt. Nobody would take a punt. And I, to be honest, didn't want to get into the record industry. And it was a mate of mine who was a distributor that said, it's about time you had your own label, so we're putting it out on PWL. That is the story, it's the truth, and I didn't want to do it, but that's we did it because we couldn't give Kylie away. That's a fact. It's incredible. 10 million people watching the show every day. The BBC had to move the show till after school because kids were wagging school and the record industry didn't see it. Don't get it. There you go. Says a lot about the record industry, really, doesn't it?
Pete, thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure.
Excuse me.
www.themouthmagazine.com.